supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
A 3-year-old boy and his mother are newly released from the Berks County Residential Center after more than a year and a half in detention. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has been following the case and the issue, and she joins me now on NewsWorks Tonight. Good evening, Laura.
Good evening, Dave.
The center is some 75 miles northwest of Philadelphia. You traveled there last evening. Where did you meet up?
So I drove to an area called Wyomissing in Berks County, where the family, mother, 27-year-old Wendy Osorio Martinez, and her 3-year-old son Diego were having dinner at a Mexican chain restaurant called Plaza Azteca. And this was their first meal out of the center in about 22 months.
And with a 3-year-old boy, it's certainly the first meal that he has any knowledge of having outside the center.
That's right. And he wanted it to be a personal pan pizza and a plate of French fries. And he spent a lot of dinner kind of watching cartoons on his phone or on somebody's phone. But yeah, his mom was reflecting to me in the restaurant just about all the milestones that he had in the center.
Does he have memories from before?
¿Tiene memorias de antes?
No, ninguna. La única memoria que él tiene es lo que ha pasado en Berks.
The only memories that he has are the memories that he made at Berks. That's the only family he knows. He had someone there who he called his dad, his grandmother. He learned how to talk and walk there. That's where he learned everything.
To what extent, though, was the mom and son in isolation versus a community of people caught in the similar circumstance?
That's a good segue into the background of the center. It's got about 95 beds. So there are always families cycling through, families who are in some kind of immigrant limbo. ICE has a lot of discretion to detain people. And so Wendy and her son were a part of this one group who crossed the border in 2015 and ended up in this long, drawn-out court case where they tried to sort of challenge the initial treatment they got when they first applied for asylum. And in that court challenge, you know, ICE decided to hold them. So they were together, about 30 families initially, although people kind of fell by the wayside, got deported, or were released over time in the Berks Center for about a year and a half when that case was decided earlier this year.
The Berks Center is one of three nationally, the other two in Texas.
That's right.
These families typically come from Central and South America. How do they bypass Texas to come to Berks County?
Right. So they have a lot of stops on their journey if they are starting in, say, Honduras, like this family. This family is from Honduras. You know, they tend to pass through Mexico. Sometimes they end up detained in Mexico or apply for asylum there. If they make it to the U.S. And they encounter Border Patrol or they declare themselves at a port of entry, they're often first put in holding areas or detention centers in Texas, in one of these other two family detention centers. And then if their case can't be resolved right away, a lot of times what happens is they get transferred up here to Pennsylvania, where families tend to be held a bit longer, and the center is a little bit better set up, from what I've heard, to house people humanely for longer periods of time.
Also at that dinner last night was counsel for the defendants. Describe the judgment in July that was a catalyst to their release this week.
That's right. So their attorneys were there celebrating with them, and I got them to explain to me a little bit about how this was able to happen, because, you know, they've been there for, like I said, 22 months, almost 2 years, and they've received a lot of bad news. So this was kind of the first good news they've gotten in a while. And it all comes down to this one court settlement that's been around since 1997 that kind of governs how the federal government is allowed to treat immigrant kids in detention. It's called the Flores Settlement. And one of their attorneys, her name's Carol Ann Donahoe, was explaining to me that what was decided last month was just that kids like Diego, like this 3-year-old, do have a right to a hearing before an immigration judge. And that's what was reaffirmed last month by a federal appeals court.
Flores says that any class member is entitled to a bond, and it doesn't matter whether you're accompanied or not accompanied. And that was another thing the government attorney tried to argue is, you know, it's only for unaccompanied minors.
But does it only apply to this specific mother and son, or can others take advantage of the same clause?
It's supposed to apply nationwide. So there are families who are held in Texas and other families at the Berks Center who could petition for this same kind of meeting before a judge. And they could, at this meeting, it's called a bond hearing, but it's basically to determine if you should continue to be confined or not. So other people can certainly ask for it, whether or not they will also be released. I think we'll be on a case-by-case basis.
What are the specific terms of this release?
Diego, the three-year-old, actually has a visa at this point. So he's on the path to a green card. He earned one while in detention. His lawyers went through the paperwork. And his mom is going to be monitored. She is going to wear an ankle monitor. They're going to move to Texas, but ICE is going to know where she is and is going to keep tabs on them.
So the Mexican meal, pan pizza, must have been a treat with French fries. But what comes next?
They had pizza, a very American dinner for Diego. And then they went to their hotel and they specifically wanted to stay at a local motel that had a pool so that Diego could go swimming. And when at dinner, he was saying repeatedly that his one goal destination right now is to go to the beach because he's seen it on television, but he hasn't seen it in real life.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks so much, Dave.
WHYY's Laura Benchoff reporting. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The unexpected death of Delaware restaurateur and humanitarian Matt Haley left many wondering about the future of his culinary empire. But almost 3 years after Haley's death, the company he founded, Sodell Concepts, is thriving. WHYY's Shirley Min reports.
Located on Route 1 in southern Delaware, Blue Coast Rehoboth is the 10th restaurant in the Sodell Concepts family. The newest member is a spinoff of Sodell's flagship seafood restaurant in North Bethany of the same name. Founder Matt Haley opened it in 2001. Scott Kammerer took over as CEO 3 years ago after Haley died in India on a humanitarian mission.
I'm big on nostalgia, and I'm big on honoring those that have come before us. So I'm really excited that we could make a place that I feel like Matt would be really happy, and he would want to hang out here, and he would really look to us and say, you guys did a really good job.
Cameron and Haley met serendipitously on the steps of a church in 1999. Both battled with addiction and were struggling for sobriety. They hit it off right away.
But looking back on it, meeting Matt that day really changed the focus and the direction of my life. He helped me be very self-aware and look within myself and try and be a better person and change the way I was looking at the world and doing business.
Together, the business partners opened 7 more restaurants in Delaware Beach towns between Lewis and Fenwick Island. The more the business grew, the more they gave back to the community. Haley's good deeds in Delaware and around the world earned him the James Beard Foundation Humanitarian of the Year Award in 2014.
He had incredible dreams and vision, and I had the ability to follow through and carry out things. So we were a good combination in a lot of ways, and Matt always was willing to take chances, and never was one to back down from a fight. And that's one thing that I think this company has really inherited from him.
And that stick-to-itiveness is paying off. What began as a small company preparing 37 dinners on its first night now cranks out 30,000 meals a week in the summertime with 1,000 employees on the payroll. Cameron and his team also inherited Haley's penchant for doing good. Sodell Cares was founded in 2015 to continue Haley's mission of helping those in the communities where Sodell Concepts does business. In its 2 years, the nonprofit has given well over $100,000 to local organizations that help kids, the elderly, and those coming out of prison.
I think that we've grown into a company that people can be proud of, that people can be proud of working here. So we spend a lot of time trying to make beautiful, simple food. We spend a lot of time developing the people we work with, and we spend a lot of time trying to make the world a better place. And that's really what the foundation of this company is, and that's the foundation of what Matt really wanted this company to be.
From the Delaware desk, Shirley Min, WHYY News.
Next up, a story about music and the quest for finding home. Local musician Umar Paracha hails from a part of northern Pakistan with a deep history of Sufism and the devotional music that goes along with it. But it wasn't until he moved to the United States thousands of miles away that he developed a close relationship with this rich tradition. Paracha brings us his story.
Hey. I grew up in Pakistan in a city called Multan. It's known as the City of Saints. It has a history of mysticism, of Sufi shrines, and it has a very long history of transcendent practices around some mainstream religious practices. Sufi music was always performed outside the shrines of saints in my hometown. And we had certain just very, like, almost mundane ritualistic practices around these shrines. Like, you know, every Thursday you knew you had to go there and distribute food because people would gather and there would just be music playing. You know, it was just sort of a part of the fabric of living. I was 18 when I came to the United States for college, and this was at Franklin and Marshall in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Wonderful experience. You know, I was just playing guitar and singing like Red Hot Chili Peppers covers and stuff, or Radiohead. Love Radiohead. But of course, there was this longing for home. I did connect deeply with other people, other friends from Pakistan, who had the context of having grown up in Pakistan in the way that I grew up, and also the shared experience of navigating this new reality in college in the States, you know. And we spent just a lot of time listening to Sufi music together from Pakistan. The music of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. He was just a very formidable culture machine. I think in any music store in Pakistan, 2/3 of all music is Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. After I graduated, in 2008, I was a year out of college and I was living in Philly and the economy crashed and I was worried about how that might affect my employment and my visa situation. I became really risk averse in terms of just like travel and anything that might impact my status. I just didn't risk it for about 8 years. That felt like a long time, and it felt like a long time for my family. So in the process of creating meaning out of this incredible amount of suffering, I think I just dedicated myself fully to pursuing music and doing well, right? And cultivating beautiful relationships here. It was only about a couple years ago that I started to actually, you know, have the courage to perform Sufi music. Some of the people that I'd been playing for about a few years, like, you know, we experimented with playing pop music. But when I started to sing this music, it enchanted them as well. My bandmate Tom Dice in his studio, he just started playing this on the guitar. He was immediately just sold, you know. In terms of the state of separation from home, there's a very parallel connection to the themes that are explored in this music. The music is about a state of separation and this longing for union. But it's much more metaphorical, and that there's a journey, inner journey involved to get to that place of union, and almost all of our actions are defined by that journey. I wasn't expecting to connect this deeply with the music. It felt both cathartic. It felt like I was finally doing something that I was meant to be doing all along. And it also felt terrifying. Still now, I feel like I need to be doing justice to it.
Umar Paracha performs with his band Falsa at Frankie Bradley's this evening with the West Philadelphia Orchestra. You can find links to his music and the backstory to his band's name on our website, newsworks.org. This segment was produced by WHYY's Alana Gordon. And finally, if you listen to or perform music that brings you closer to home, we'd like to hear from you. Tweet us at newsworks.WHYY. Author Lisa Graff of Narberth has a new novel for younger readers out this summer. She's been considered for the National Book Award in 2013 for her book entitled A Tangle of Knots. Her newly published book for kids takes on a heavy subject in a lighthearted way. The Great Treehouse War is about a fifth grader named Winnie. Her parents are getting divorced, and in protest, she decides to live in her treehouse and not come down. Graf came into our studio to speak with reporter Peter Crimmins. She began by reading a passage from The Great Treehouse War when Winnie's parents told her and her cat Buttons to come into the living room for an important talk.
There was a tiny X of masking tape stuck to the center of the middle couch cushion. Her parents, Winnie realized as she stepped closer, had measured out a spot for her so that she'd be sitting exactly evenly between them, not 1 millimeter closer to one than the other. But Winnie, who was pretty used to her parents being weird, decided there was nothing to do but sit. Button sat too, hopping right into her lap. "Winifred," her mom said. She cleared her throat. "Your father and I..." "Oh no," Winnie's dad cut in, putting up a hand to stop Winnie's mom. "We agreed I would tell her. You got to tell Winifred about the tooth fairy." Winnie's mom frowned. "I don't see how that's pertinent, Varun. This is entirely different..." "We discussed this," Winnie's dad argued. "But once again, you're attempting to ruin..." While Winnie's parents argued, Buttons purred a little louder in Winnie's lap, scrunching his head under her hand. Winnie scratched and scratched at Buttons' soft orange fur while her parents argued and argued. Winnie watched her mom, so angry with her dad. She watched her dad, so furious with her mom. Her parents might have been acting weird, Winnie realized. But the fighting, that was completely normal. And when she realized that, Winnie knew deep in her gut precisely why her parents had sat her down on that tiny X of masking tape.
And this is Lisa Graf. She's the author of what you've just heard. Her new book for younger readers is called The Great Treehouse War. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I thought this was interesting because you're writing a book about divorce for young readers, but you're doing it with a very light touch. That can't be easy to do, to take on a really... It can be traumatic. I mean, divorce can be traumatic, but you're doing it with a certain dash of humor.
Right. Well, I went in wanting it to be really goofy, and I've dealt with divorce in some of my other books. It's something I have experience with. My parents divorced when I was 4, so it was my reality growing up. But for this book, I wanted to focus on really the absurdity that can happen when parents divorce and how they try to one-up each other. And it can be really funny and weird, and I thought that was a great way to approach it.
As the story goes on, her parents divorce. They live in separate houses, and right in the middle of their houses is a very large tree in which a house is built, a tree house. And she decides to protest her parents' bickering post-divorce by living in the treehouse, and her friends decide to join her, and hilarity ensues.
Right.
Part of, I think, what the Winnie is reacting to is her parents' divorce, but also they're trying to monopolize her time. Mm-hmm. These parents are smothering her. They're scheduling her time to such a degree that she's being suffocated. And
right.
That seems to be a really big driver of this story.
They adore Winnie. They love her. She's the center of their world. But they become so obsessed with proving to the other parent that they love her more that they don't really allow her space to breathe and do the things she wants to do and just even have time to do her homework. So again, that goes back to the absurdity of it. But I also wanted to juxtapose that with her friends who end up having gripes with their parents that are sort of more grounded and normal.
And what you've created is a situation which might be almost every child's great wish
right.
is to live away from your parents without the trouble of actually running away from home. But you get to live in a house with your friends, with your parents being out of the picture for
mm-hmm.
a while. I think that's a fantasy that many young children entertain.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it sounds really, really fun. And it in the book, it goes really well until it goes really badly.
And then it all comes crashing down.
Right.
Now, The Great Treehouse War is set. You live in Narberth? Did I
yes.
get that right? And you're moving soon.
I am, yes.
To another suburb of Philadelphia.
Yes.
You're not from here. You're from California,
mm-hmm.
the Big Bear. And now you find yourself in this neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, The Great Treehouse War is set. I think you actually are... It's a fictional town, I should
yes.
say. You don't try to recreate Philadelphia, but you do name drop
yeah.
the town where this takes place.
Yeah, that was really fun. I'm trying to even remember the fictional town. I think it's Glenbrook. I threw in Glens and Brooks and Mars and tried to come up with something that wasn't real, and then I kept Googling it, and they were all real. but it's basically the suburbs of Philadelphia.
You said that you yourself, when you were young, your parents divorced
mm-hmm.
when you were 4, very young. And I'm wondering if, in writing this book, do you sense that this is the kind of book that you would have wanted when you were a girl? trying to cope with your family life?
Yeah, it's funny because my first, I guess, four novels that I wrote had very traditional, quote unquote, traditional families where the parents were married. And even though I dealt with other larger issues in those books, divorce wasn't a thing. And then I started to write my fourth book and I realized, you know, I don't know why I keep writing about kids with married parents. That was not my experience. I had step-parents, I had step-brothers and sisters, I had half-brothers and sisters. And so I thought, you know, there's a lot of kids living that reality. When I was a kid, I remember one book that I found with divorced parents, and I loved it because it didn't deal with it in this really traumatic way. It was just the reality that these kids lived in. And I really clung to that book because it spoke to me and it reflected my reality a little bit more.
Author Lisa Graff speaking with WHYY's Peter Crimmins. After nearly 3,700 miles, former Delaware Governor Jack Markell completed his cross-country bike ride as he arrived in Rehoboth Beach this afternoon. Details from WHYY's Mark Eichmann.
Here he comes!
With cheering kids from the Boys and Girls Club lining Rehoboth Avenue, Markell completed the trip he started on June 18th in Astoria, Oregon. Since the cross-country ride began with his back tire in the Pacific Ocean, Markell bookended his ride by dipping his front tire in the Atlantic Ocean as hundreds of supporters and curious beachgoers looked on. As difficult as the ride was physically, averaging more than 80 miles a day, Markell said it wasn't any more challenging than what he's faced as Delaware's governor for 8 years during a time of recession.
The difference, you know, in all of those other challenges is that my decisions affected a lot of other people. And so that's it's a big burden. It's a really important responsibility. Whereas in this, it was really about me. But certainly when you have to climb 5,000 feet and you got a stiff headwind and you think, oh my gosh, I have 45 more days of this, then it's difficult.
Markell partnered with the group Motivate the First State to raise money during his ride and encourage Delawareans to get physically active. That effort has raised more than $120,000, with supporters walking or biking more than 115,000 miles total since June 1st. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.